2SER 107.3.
Hello and welcome to The Wire. My name is Stephen Regal from 4EB in Brisbane today. Today, there's uneasiness in the health sector over unpublished advice from the tobacco industry on the government's new drug strategy.
If we go by the sort of track record of these organizations, they use, you know, phony science to support their claims. They request that policies be self-regulatory and that they generally don't accept policies that will generally work to reduce consumption.
Concern over unfunded medical placements in Queensland, a further push to completely outlaw nuclear weapons, and we look at grants awarded to combat disadvantage in rural areas.
Another really huge issue in rural and regional Australia is food relief. So people who live outside of capital cities have an 11% greater need for food relief.
Stay tuned for all that and more independent current affairs across Australia. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be with you for the next half hour. But before we get started, Eduardo Jordan is here to tell us about some of the other big stories from today. So first off, it seems Westpac has ruled out funding the Adani coal mine.
Yes, that's right. Westpac released its updated climate change action plan today, ruling out financing new thermal coal mines outside the top 15% of energy quality globally. The move effectively rules out Adani's Carmichael mine in Queensland because the energy content of the coals is nearly 20% less than that benchmark. Environmentalists 350.org and Market Forces have hailed the result, but Federal Resources Minister Matthew Canavan says the bank has turned its back on Queensland. This makes Westpac the last of the big four banks to distance itself from the project.
And it's come out that the federal police has acted illegally.
Yes, that's right, Stephen. The Commissioner of the Australian Federal Police, Mark Colvin, today admitted the agency accessed the phone records of a journalist without getting the correct warrant for the information. Mr. Colvin says once they realized the action has breached the Telecommunications Interception Act, the AFP dropped, quote, all investigations relating to this inquiry, end of quote. While the journalist involved has not been informed, Mr. Colvin revealed the incident has been referred to the Commonwealth Ombudsman for investigation, saying he wants the public to have, quote, full confidence in the police, end of quote.
This was human error. It should not have occurred. The AFP takes it very seriously, and we take full responsibility for breaching the act. But I also want to say that there was no ill will or malice or bad intent by the officers involved who breached the act.
And it seems all sorts of things might be on the cards now with the government changing its tune on debt.
That's correct. Following Treasurer Scott Morrison's speech yesterday about the difference between good and bad debt, speculation has raged about this means for next month's budget. Speaking to Australian business economists, Mr. Morrison categorised good debt as projects that will produce income over time and bad debt as spending that simply drains the government's finances. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull gave an example yesterday, calling a $10 billion freight rail link between Melbourne and Brisbane an example of good debt. There has been media speculation the change in tune might see funding for projects like Sydney's second airport or Brisbane's Cross River Rail.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
Well, the Australian government is currently updating the national drug strategy to reduce the use of harmful, illegal and legal drugs, including alcohol and tobacco. previous submissions to the National Drug Strategy were made publicly available, but the government has failed to disclose advice that includes representatives from the powerful tobacco and alcohol industries. Sunita Osborne reports.
The Australian government is in the process of developing a new national drug strategy to reduce the supply, demand and harm of alcohol, tobacco and other drugs. The process of the latest strategy includes consultations with various health communities and companies, as well as representatives from the tobacco and alcohol sector. The government has failed to publish recent submissions for the National Drug Strategy, even though previous submissions were always made publicly available. Researcher at the University of Sydney, Dr. Becky Freeman, is concerned government policy will be affected by the unpublished submissions from the alcohol and tobacco industries.
Well, at this stage, it's really hard to say. We have no idea what was in those submissions, the kind of policies they were advocating for. But if we go by the sort of track record of these organizations, they use, you know, phony science to support their claims. They request that policies be self-regulatory and voluntary rather than entrenched in law with severe penalties for violation, and that they generally don't accept policies that will generally work to reduce consumption, that they, you know, support policies that sound nice and friendly and that are children-centered, but really they have no interest in affecting their bottom line.
Dr. Alex Wodak, president of the Australian Drug and Reform Foundation, says that unpublished submissions are embarrassing.
They're not doing this unless there's a good reason for it. It's a politically risky thing to do, in the sense that if the government is caught out, as they have been, it's going to be very embarrassing for the government as to why they did this.
Dr. Freeman says it's essential for the arguments of alcohol and tobacco companies to be open to public debate.
In previous consultations for the drug strategy about 5 years ago, there was tobacco and alcohol submissions made then, but those have been made public, so there's an opportunity for civil society to critique those and to give feedback to government as to, you know, why they need to be wary of the points that are being raised in there, and it's a lot more transparent and open, and that's essential because if these industries are influencing drug policy, it's not in the best interest of the health for Australians.
Both agree the government has made significant strides in controlling the use of tobacco, yet more can still be done to ensure that the national drug strategy is effective.
Well, there's more not working than there is working. What's working are things like reducing the prevalence of smoking. It's taken a long time, and we're now not doing that as well as other countries, including notably the United States, where prevalence of smoking in an environment currently supportive of e-cigarettes is now lower than in Australia. Lowering the prevalence of smoking over 40 years has been one of the biggest public health achievements in Australia. I think also the control of HIV and the response now to hepatitis C has been largely successful.
I think we've made incredible progress, particularly in tobacco control. I mean, we were the first nation to adopt this sort of generic standardized packaging of tobacco products back in 2011. And that means that all the products that are sold in tobacco, or all the tobacco products, sorry, that are sold in Australia now no longer have branding on them or logos or have appealing packaging designs. But that was back in 2011. So we've had, you know, a few years now where we haven't had any new policies come out in tobacco control. And so the drug strategy is a really good chance to say, you know what, this policy is firmly embedded now. Let's move forward. And I'm encouraged that we do have a new health minister now, Greg Hunt, and he is on record of saying that tobacco control is a priority for him. So I think this is a golden opportunity to do something, again, that's world-leading, that's visionary, that will bring smoking rates down.
Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt has yet to comment on the missing submissions. We reached out for comment with various members from the drug treatment sector, but they declined our requests for an interview.
That story was by Sunita Osborne. Farmers in rural areas face tough challenges reaching basic services. Many need to travel long distances just to get the basics. That's why an organization is putting up money to solve these issues in an innovative way. Eduardo Jordan has more.
Aussie Farmers Foundation was set up to provide support to organizations who are working in rural and regional Australia. And we provide funding across five key focus areas. These are issues that are affecting Australians outside of the metropolitan areas, and that is farm sustainability, disaster relief and recovery, kids' health and healthy eating, food relief and food waste, and mental health of farming communities.
That was fundraising manager from Aussie Farmers Foundation, Jane Thomas. Aussie Farmers Foundation has opened its third round of applications for the Rural Hero Grant.
The Rural Hero Grant was set up to provide organisations with an opportunity to get their message out about the projects that they're working on, the issues that are relevant in their local communities, but also to give them funding so they can get out there and do what they do best in their local communities.
Ms. Thomas says the grant will help not-for-profit organisations help their communities and raise awareness about problems in farming areas.
We really wanted to set up a grant that provided an organisation that was doing great work out in rural and regional communities and working with farming communities and give them the opportunity to either continue a fantastic project that they're doing or to come up with a really innovative idea that helps to address some of the key issues impacting on farming communities. We also wanted to get awareness out there, so really make sure that as many Australians as possible know what's happening outside of the key cities in Australia.
Last year, Royal Far West, an organisation based in New South Wales, used the grant to create a health program for farmers' children called Healthy Kids Bus Stop. Royal Far West Community Manager John Reid.
It is basically a developmental screening program aimed at 3 to 5 year olds in, again, the rural and regional areas of New South Wales. We work in close conjunction with some of the local health districts, and particularly with this award, we work with three, the Hunter New England, Mid-North Coast and Murrumbidgee health districts, and they're great partners that we have. We establish a team of clinical specialists. They would be a group of nurses. We normally have 4. We have a speech therapist, a occupational therapist, an oral health team, a dietitian, and also an audiometrist that comes as part of the package. We set up all these various stations within the hall, and children come in with their families in that 3 to 5 age group, and they go from station to station.
And thanks to this grant, their operations grew.
In particular, the $50,000 we got through the Aussie Farmers Foundation, the Aussie Heroes grant, we were able to conduct virtually another 3 Healthy Kids bus stops. So we were able to do one in Muswellbrook, we were able to do one on the Mid-North Coast, and we were able to do one in West Wyalong. And amongst those 3, we saw over 200 children.
To obtain the grant, organisations have to follow some requirements. Ms. Thomas says the foundation is looking for creative ideas.
We really want to look at as many organisations as possible. So the process with the Rural Hero Grant is that people put in and organisations put in an expression of interest, and that's open until the 31st of May. So there are some criteria, some eligibility criteria that organisations need to look at, but really, we really want to hear innovative solutions. We want, you know, whatever's happening in your local area, let us know about it, put in an application. We will be shortlisting from that, so 3 to 5 organisations will be shortlisted, and then we'll ask them to create a video. It doesn't have to be a slick professional video. We're looking for up to 1.5 minutes maximum.
But they aren't just looking to give the money away. Royal Far West's John Reid says Aussie Farmers Foundation were really interested in the project and followed them up.
I think one of the things we've been delighted with is Aussie farmers have a real interest in the outcomes. They're not just trying to give away money they have to give away. They have a real interest in the outcomes of the programs that are funded through this. And I would really suggest that there's so much need out in regional and rural communities. There's a great lack of service, and to really embrace the partnership with Aussie Farmers Foundation.
And that was Royal Far West's Community Manager, John Reid. If you'd like more information about the grants, you can go to our website, thewire.org.au. That story was by Eduardo Jordan. The International Red Cross is stepping up its efforts to stop weapons proliferation by further promoting a total ban on nuclear weapons at their conference this week. Danielle Daly reports.
A proposal to ban nuclear weapons was discussed at the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Movement conference in Nagasaki this week. The Red Cross has advocated for the banning of nuclear weapons since 1945, with Australian Red Cross spokesperson on nuclear weapons, Dr. Phoebe Wynne Pope, saying, "Banning nuclear weapons is the only safe option for humanity." Dr. Wynne Pope spoke further about the aims of this conference.
The Red Cross and Red Crescent movement has been working towards banning nuclear weapons since 1945, the first call for the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we met back in Nagasaki just this week to look at how we can continue to progress the movement towards the elimination and prohibition of nuclear weapons.
The conference stemmed from United Nations negotiations in March, which advocated for a ban on nuclear weapons, although none of the countries who possessed the weapons were present and Australia was absent. The United States Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, said that they would love to have a ban on nuclear weapons, but they couldn't possibly give them up while those who were bad sought to acquire them. While UK Ambassador Matthew Rycroft said that there has been a vast reduction in nuclear weapons in his country, and he didn't believe the talks would result in a meaningful reduction of stockpiles. But Dr. Wynne Pope says the opposition is based on a flawed idea of the usefulness of nuclear weapons.
I think if we start to argue that the only way we can be safe from nuclear weapons is by having nuclear weapons, it becomes a very circular argument, which fails to recognise the nature of the weapons themselves. There is no safe nuclear weapon.
Dr. Wynne Pope says the weapons are unsafe in any situation, whether they're used on purpose or by mistake.
Well, I think what we know is that catastrophic, the humanitarian consequences of any use of nuclear weapons, and whether that's an accident or a purposeful use or a miscalculation of nuclear weapons, is almost unthinkable. It's very well recognised that the capacity for the Red Cross and other humanitarian organisations to respond would be almost impossible, and that, you know, any small-level nuclear exchange, what that would mean is, with the environmental modelling and what have you, is that you could end up in a situation where you have mass starvation, climate change unlike anything we've seen before. So the question is this: is any use of nuclear weapons, or is the existence of nuclear weapons, adding to our security or adding to our insecurity? And I think that what we would say is that the very existence of nuclear weapons is such a risk to humankind that it's not worth contemplating. So the sooner that we can prohibit them and eliminate all nuclear weapons, the better. In Nagasaki this week, we heard from William Perry, who was the Secretary for Defence under the Bill Clinton administration, and he was telling the story about how a training disc had been left in a computer, and what had happened was he had been woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning and told that there were 200 missiles on their way to the United States, and it turned out to be pure human error. And thank goodness for human thoroughness in the fact that was not responded to with a nuclear strike. But
so, what is likely to happen at the next round of UN discussions? Is Australia likely to take a place in the negotiations?
So I think that it's very likely that at the United Nations in June and July of this year, that we will see the establishment of a treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons. They're the only weapons of mass destruction that haven't been specifically prohibited. So we've prohibited chemical and biological weapons, we've prohibited landmines, we've prohibited other forms of weapons of mass destruction, but not these ones. So it's very likely that there will be a treaty by mid-July.
And that story was by Danielle Daly. And you're listening to The Wire. We broadcast all around the country on community and Indigenous Radio. That's Karma Radio Alice Springs, the Black Star Network, and the Community Radio Network across the country. The Wire is today coming to you from 4EB in Brisbane. Our other partners are Radio Adelaide in Adelaide, 2SER in Sydney, and RTR-FM in Perth. If you like anything that you heard here today on the program, you can just go to thewire.org.au and check out any of the stories there and listen back to them as well. And also check us out on Twitter. That's just The Wire Radio, all one word. And on Facebook, The Wire Independent Current Affairs on Community Radio. Well, Queensland's Health Minister Cameron Dick has threatened to withdraw funding for additional medical internship placements at the Sunshine Coast University Hospital if the positions aren't granted to domestic students. But well, how will the standoff affect medical students? Emily Campbell has the story.
Yesterday, Sunshine Coast Federal MPs Ted O'Brien and Andrew Wallace announced the Australian government would support 50 spots for medical students at a newly opened teaching hospital. But the federal government has only allocated funds for 35 positions, despite Griffith University having asked for money to guarantee 50 student doctor placements. According to the university, 15 of 50 medical internships available at the hospital will need to be filled by international students in order for the program to go ahead. Karen Cochrane, a spokeswoman for the Council of International Students Australia, says although they receive a great education in Australia, international students face hurdles, including language barriers and financial distress.
An international student can pay up to 4 times the amount of a domestic student in the country, depending on the degree. You have students that come from different countries, such as China or some of the other Asian countries, that English is not their first language, so they might get really great scores on their exam, but they don't have the conversational English that some Western countries have.
The Australian Medical Students Association president, Rob Thomas, says placements in Australian hospitals are a compulsory training step doctors must undertake in order to graduate.
It requires a full medical degree, which can take between 4 and 6 years, depending on the university in Australia. And then crucially, after you graduate from medical school, you must complete an internship, which has to be an Australian internship, otherwise there are a few internationally approved internships, and that's the same whether you're a domestic or international student.
Mr. Thomas explained that there has been a drastic increase in students studying medicine, which has led to a shortage of internship positions for graduate doctors.
We certainly don't want any increases in domestic student numbers, but likewise, AMSA is strongly against any increases in international student numbers as well, because whether graduates be from an international or domestic background, it puts a strain on the health system trying to find internships for them, and we're already seeing the health system basically at capacity when it comes to internships.
Revenue from education reached a record figure of $21.8 billion last year, with trade figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics showing a drastic increase of 17% from the previous year. Education is Australia's third largest export behind coal and iron ore. And while Mr. Thomas isn't concerned by the level of funding for medicine, he says there is a problem with how it is used.
We believe that overall funding is pretty reasonable, but what we're seeing is a maldistribution of doctors in Australia. So there's not enough doctors in rural areas, and we need to focus on proven efforts that increase doctors in rural areas, not just increase medical student numbers and medical graduate numbers overall.
Ms. Cochrane agrees that universities and the government must take steps to ensure that there are an equal amount of graduate jobs for both domestic and international medical students.
They need to think logically of how many people that they're putting through the programs and be able to make sure that everyone receives a job when they graduate.
The Queensland Minister for Health says that the state government pledged $3.2 million to the program to train aspiring Australian medical students, and that it would be a kick in the guts for the spots to be filled by international students. It is unsure if the Griffith University Medical Training Program will go ahead at the Sunshine Coast University Hospital. Griffith's governing body is meeting in June to consider the matter.
So in the past decade or so, we've seen a huge increase in medical student numbers. It's reached the stage where workforce projections are that we'll have an oversupply of doctors.
And that report was by Emily Campbell. That's the show for today. Great to have you with us wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between Radio Adelaide, 2SER in Sydney, 4EB in Brisbane, RTR FM in Perth, Karma Radio Alice Springs, and is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can hear The Wire weekdays same time on your local community radio station. If you'd like to hear us again, just go to thewire.org.au. And on Twitter, The Wire Radio, all one word, Facebook, The Wire, Independent Current Affairs on Community Radio. And if you'd like to stay up to date with what we're doing day to day, sign up to our mailing list. Just go to the contact page on our website. Today's program came to you from our studios here in Brisbane. My name is Stephen McGall. Thank you so much for your company, and we will see you next time on The Wire.
An opportunity of a lifetime to enhance your skills overseas and expand your global networks awaits you. The Australian Government's Australia Awards, Endeavour Scholarships and Fellowships provides financial support for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples to undertake study, professional development or research overseas towards an Australian Master's, PhD or postdoctoral research in any field. Further your studies around the world and improve the outcomes for future generations of Indigenous Australians. For more information, see the Endeavour Scholarships and Fellowships website.
2SER sponsor.